is Mindy Erickson. Dr. Erickson is the groundwater specialist in the Minnesota Water Science Center of the USGS and an adjunct faculty member of the University of Minnesota. Her primary research interests are the geochemistry, fate, and transport of organic chemicals and metals in groundwater. Mindy's talk today is entitled Contaminants of Emerging Concern in Minnesota Waters.
Good. Well, thanks very much. It's actually a little challenging to be the caboose on the end of this train of talks today, but I'll do my best to keep your interest until 4:30. It's a great topic, and hopefully I'll be able to do justice with it today. The USGS has defined or categorized contaminants of emerging concern over the past 20-plus years in a pretty broad way. It's a very big group of chemicals, and in general, what these chemicals have in common is that they don't have an established regulatory limit. So there's not a HURL, there's not an MCL, there's not a discharge standard for NPDES permit, that sort of thing. So really no established discharge limits related to these compounds. Along with that, they're a group of chemicals that all of us use every day in our regular life. We use them when we shower, we use them when we brush our teeth, we use them when we clean around the house, we use them in many, many different ways around the house. And so these chemicals are going into our wastewater stream, into our wastewater treatment plants, and being discharged into surface water through one route, and then also through other kinds of waste disposal routes that we have. The treatment systems that we have in place, they were never meant to deal with these kinds of contaminants. And so we have infrastructure in place to deal with things like nitrate and solids and some of those sorts of things. But these contaminants of emerging concern, in general, we don't know a lot about how they're being managed and discharged from the treatment facilities that we have for waste systems in the state. And so that's part of what we've looked at as our guidance for what we're looking at from the USGS and federal perspective. Of particular interest is a subgroup of these contaminants of emerging concern that are called endocrine active compounds. So these are specific chemicals within this group of unregulated contaminants that we know have action on the endocrine system in our bodies and also in the wildlife that we have, in fish systems, that sort of thing. So they have ecological impacts as well. They were designed to be active on our systems. They're pharmaceuticals and that sort of thing. And so that was their purpose in life. But now that they're in the waste stream, we really don't want them to have all that much action anymore, but they still do. And so that's a subgroup that's of particular interest. Some examples are given here with some pictures. I forgot I had this slide next, or I would have put that up next. The Department of Health has defined chemicals of emerging concern in a little bit different way, a little bit more specific way, related to its new program that is developing health-based guidance for contaminants of emerging concern and a prioritization level for development of these health this health-based guidance. So there are substances that have been released to or could be released to Minnesota waters and don't already have any guidance, pose a real or perceived threat, and have either new information available or changing information available related to exposure and toxicity. And why do we care? I touched on that a little bit already. These chemicals are entering our waters. They're entering our waters, and they are having, we're all being exposed, our ecosystems are being exposed, and we really should, as a society, make a decision about whether or not it's worth doing something about this suite of chemicals. So to better understand how widespread they are, what concentrations they're at, what effects are we already seeing in our ecological system, they're all factors that come into play with regard to our next steps. So in this talk, I want to state right up front, I've been with USGS for only 3 years, and so the whole first part of my talk is going to be related to work that was done by my colleague Kathy Lee and a whole army of other people long before I even joined the USGS, but I wanted to just give some historical perspective and let you know a little bit about the work that's happened in Minnesota over the past couple of decades. Then I'm going to go on to a more recent study, again led by Kathy Lee, related specifically to looking at releases from wastewater treatment plants and some of the eco effects that were measured related to these discharges. And then also touch on a current study that I'm involved with, working cooperatively with the Pollution Control Agency, taking advantage of the new ambient groundwater monitoring network that's being put into place and expanding the suite of chemicals that are being measured in these wells to include some contaminants of emerging concern. So CEC research around the country, USGS has been involved both at the national level and at the local level through our toxics hydrology, USGS toxics hydrology program, the National Water Quality Assessment Program, which many of you are familiar with the acronym NAQUA, that's what that is, and then also at the science center level, both biological science centers, water science centers, other types of specific discipline science centers that we have within the USGS. At the more local level, we've been involved in the science centers working with partners, and many of you fall into that category of partners that USGS works with throughout the state. And here in Minnesota, we have two locations, one here in the Twin Cities, and then a second facility up in Grand Rapids. And the National Toxics Program has been looking at a source-to-receptor framework for exploring contaminants of emerging concern, looking at sources and pathways to strictly occurrence, fate and transport issues, and then also looking at receptors and impacts on receptors. Another key piece that USGS has been involved with is developing methods for measuring these contaminants of emerging concern at fairly low concentrations in different media. So not just groundwater, but surface water and sediment and plant materials and in biological specimens like fish and that sort of thing too. So methods development has been a big part of what USGS has focused on over the years. Monitoring through our Water Science Center here in Minnesota has been something that has continued over the course of these two decades, by and large, because of the interest of the staff that we have at the Science Center. Kathy Lee, again, has been really instrumental in keeping this work moving forward. I'm involved now with the USGS, as is my colleague Richard Kiesling. So the three of us are part of the key team that are keeping this work going now. And we're also dependent on finding local cooperators and state agency people, et cetera, who want to work together with us to get these projects done. The funding mechanism is both local dollars and federal dollars coming together to leverage one another to do a better piece of work than either could do individually. So some of the partnerships that have been in place over the 90s and 2000s, we've worked in partnership with many of the state agencies here in Minnesota, universities that are around the state, and also with some of our sister agencies at the federal level, EPA, NPS, and then also across disciplines within USGS, water, biology, the National Research Program, and again the Toxics Program that's been instrumental throughout the history of the CEC research around the country. Been doing both field studies and controlled exposure studies, so it's been at both different scales trying to get a handle on the whole scope of the issue. Numerous publications have come from these studies that have been done, and hopefully many and any of you who are interested in this will be able to find information that you're looking for from these past studies in either USGS reports or peer-reviewed literature. This is just a list of some of the individual studies to indicate the breadth and length of time that the work has been happening. From the early mid-90s, there's been work done looking strictly at fish, looking at drinking water, looking at surface water, working with state agencies, working with the universities. And so there's really a long history here, and it's really, really a pleasure to be a part of it at this time. The goal of this integrated long-term research is to look at the extent of currents and then take that next step further to think about fate and transport, and then the so what question of why do we care that these chemicals are present at relatively low concentrations, what effects are they having? And as I'll talk about in a little bit, there is quite good evidence now regarding these endocrine active compounds disrupting the endocrine systems, and in fish specifically has been one of the organisms studied quite a bit. So a quick summary of some of the work that's happened from the 90s through the late 2000s. The work that's been done has included looking at concentrations of CECs in sediment from stream beds and rivers, looking at water concentrations primarily in surface water up through recently, and then characterization of different types of fish responses to being exposed to these different chemicals in the environment. So detections in surface water across the state, as you can see, quite a number of locations have been sampled both in more rural or agricultural watersheds and then also in the more urban areas in the Twin Cities. And as you can see, the white boxes show where measurements were taken and there were no detections of these EACs specifically from this group of studies were not detected. But there are also a very large number of locations that were sampled and there were these chemicals detected. And they're not necessarily in areas that you might think would be most impacted by the chemicals. It's not strictly surrounding urban areas, but rather spread quite diffusely around the state. So these are detections of the chemicals in bed sediment versus in the water column. And one of the concerns related specifically to these chemicals being detected in bed sediment is that they'll continue to be a source as time goes on. So for the moment, the chemicals are adsorbed to bed sediments, but if the chemical conditions change, if we have high water flows and sediment is stirred up, if you know the catfish come and they stir things up, the sediment can be redistributed and those chemicals can be released then back into the water column. This is looking at another phase of the work that's been looking at fish specifically and undesirable responses in fish related to exposures to endocrine active compounds. And the blue dots on the stream there indicate locations where there were male fish found that had oocytes, which are eggs, so male fish having eggs present, and then also locations where vitellogenin was present in a male fish, and vitellogenin is an egg yolk indicator compound, and so also something that one doesn't expect to find in the male fish. One of the take-home messages, again, from this is that these undesirable traits in the male fish from these endocrine active compounds are found in very wide range of ecological settings. So it's not just a setting, you know, immediately downstream of a wastewater treatment plant discharge or something of that sort, but rather in a very wide range of environmental settings. And these different traits and characteristics were noted in different fish species, not just one. So again, this is reiterating the point that the compounds in sediment may serve as this potential long-term reservoir and source of these compounds to the water column and to the fish that live in the environment. Another point is that the discharge concentrations of these compounds vary widely, both between discharge location and between sampling event at one particular location. So this, the graph on the right-hand side here, each of these columns indicate an individual sampling location, and over a different time period. And so even at one location, you can see order of magnitude change in concentration detected of this one compound that's looked at here, nonylphenol. Varying again widely between locations as well. A couple of them had no detected nonylphenol in any sampling event, and a couple of them had up to 10 micrograms per liter of nonylphenol in the wastewater effluent. So in an on-site exposure study, some of the questions, specific questions that have been looked at are, does the effluent, taking this effluent directly, elicit this endocrine disruption in the fish species? So can we actually just say that from having these controlled exposure studies? what is the change in response over time, and which chemicals are present. Another factor is the hydrology of the receiving water over time as the wastewater is discharged. As you can see from this graph, the percent of, depending on if you have a large stream or a small stream and what the background concentration is of this, or not concentration, but flow rate is of the receiving stream, the percentage of that full stream flow that can be made up by the wastewater effluent can be pretty big at some times of the year. And so you can see it, especially in the South Fork of the Crow River, in February and October, so during low flow times of the year, the wastewater effluent makes up over 50% or around 50% of the total stream flow. So you can imagine that the organisms who are living in these streams are experiencing a very different chemical environment if the wastewater effluent is 50% of the stream flow versus 10% or 5% of the stream flow. So a very different environment can be created based on the hydrology of the particular system. So as a summary of some of these field and lab studies, we know that the compounds are present. And some of the things to focus on are that the life stage of the exposure is an important factor, that the chemistry and effects can vary over time, and we have a lot of unknown sources that are being discharged to our waterways. And some of the gaps, sources, better ideas about temporal variability, fate, persistence, partitioning are things that aren't really well understood at this point. When we're looking at the exposed species, looking at actual effects versus biomarkers of effects and the relative strength of each of those types of approaches. And then continuing with some of the laboratory and controlled studies to really try and identify some of the more important aspects of the exposure and the ecosystem response to exposures to these chemicals. And then finally, something that's very difficult to try and tease apart, but is the reality, is that nobody and nothing is exposed to just one chemical. It's always a mixture of chemicals in these exposures. And so how to try and understand and quantify what these mixtures mean to an ecosystem. So we have a number of different current studies underway. One of the studies is related to looking at aquatic systems that are known to be receiving groundwater discharge that are under the influence of septic releases, so septic systems discharging to surface water source relatively close down gradient. Doing some controlled exposures in mesocosms, looking at occurrence in the St. Lawrence Bay and then the occurrence study that we have going on right now in shallow groundwater. So the wastewater treatment plant study that was conducted in cooperation with the Pollution Control Agency in 2009 and 2010. The contaminants of emerging concern were measured in several different media, surface water both upstream and downstream of a wastewater treatment plant discharge point, bed sediment, the effluent itself, and then also at some select locations, the stream biological characteristics were measured. And one other thing that was measured was the time of travel of the wastewater effluent as it went downstream. So to collect all these different kinds of samples, obviously we had a small army of people out doing this work, collecting water from the water column, upstream and downstream of the discharge point, measuring the stream discharge, measuring the time of travel, collecting those sediment samples, and then processing, shipping, and keeping track of all the samples that were involved. So just a few photographs to demonstrate the scope of work that this project was for these almost 50 sites. This is just some photographs showing the settings for a couple of these different systems. I've got four of them here, two that are more rural areas and two that are more urban areas. So just to show you what upstream and then the discharge from the treatment plant and downstream look like. and then collecting sediment samples upstream of the treatment plant as well. So this is in Williams. And then in Austin, a similar kind of setting where not very developed along that stream bank edge, discharge from the treatment plant, and then demonstration of the time of travel work using the rhodamine dye. In Duluth, pretty different kind of a setting where its discharge goes into the bay there. So looking upstream, up the river, and then at the treatment plant, and then downstream, and then there at the treatment plant itself collecting that effluent sample. And then also an urban area here in the metro area, Met Council's wastewater treatment plant upstream, paddling up to the discharge point, and then the downstream sampling as well. So what did we find in this study? And the bottom axis is the number of chemicals that were detected, the number of times any particular chemical was detected across the sampling, and this is strictly for the water. So things like carbamazepine, sulfamethoxazole, trimethoprim, which are pharmaceutical compounds, these were all detected at quite a few of the locations that were sampled. The average number of chemicals detected at any one location upstream of the discharge point from the wastewater treatment plant, less than one on average detected per location. At the treatment plant, just over four, and then downstream, two. At Austin, you could really see the demonstration of this in looking at a few particular chemicals, caffeine being the blue line, which you see there. Somehow I always have to laugh when I see the caffeine line. But right there at the treatment plant, it's demonstrably higher than either upstream or downstream at this particular location. And the nitrate and chloride results mimic what we see for the discharge of the more exotic chemicals that we're looking at now. So on to the work that we're doing presently with the Pollution Control Agency on doing this expanded sampling of the new and developing ambient groundwater monitoring network. This network has been in place for a long time, and what's been added now is to do the first comprehensive survey of contaminants of emerging concern in vulnerable aquifers and vulnerable groundwater in the state. And so PCA and USGS have been working cooperatively on this since 2009, and we're scheduled to be working on it through 2014 and potentially beyond, depending on what we find. So the results that are presented here today are from just the first year of sampling, so the 2009-2010 sampling period. And you can look for an update at the conference in the fall. So during that first year, we sampled 40 wells. And they were, again, chosen to be wells where we expected to find contamination if it would be present. So we were looking at vulnerable wells and vulnerable aquifer settings. And it was the wells are also chosen across a range of land uses. So urban land uses, commercial land uses, more undeveloped land uses, et cetera. And again, we're looking for wells that we know or suspect already have the potential to be vulnerable to surface impacts and groundwater impacts. And so using something like elevated boron, which is a compound that's present in washing fluids and that sort of thing, suggests that the groundwater may already be under the influence of contamination from some sort of a source. There are also three wells that were located down gradient of the leachate plume at landfills. And these landfills were ones that had been closed for at least 15 years. So sampling involved what I hope most of us are familiar with regard to groundwater sampling, purging of the well, sampling of the water. Because we are sampling for these chemicals of emerging concern at very low concentration, and we already know that they're present everywhere in our environment, it really was an important looking at keeping ourselves from contaminating the samples was an important piece. So one of the things we're looking for is DEET, for example. So, you know, I felt sorry for the samplers who are out there in the summertime and have to have the DEET-free living, sunscreen products, that sort of thing. So really trying away from personally using any of the chemicals that we're trying to sample for, and then also doing a lot of quality control samples, doing field blanks and duplicates to ensure that we're quantifying any introduced contamination into the process, because we're looking at part per trillion to low part per billion level concentrations. All the laboratory analyses were done at the USGS laboratories, and we're looking at three different groups of chemicals: anthropogenic, organic chemicals, the pharmaceuticals, and then hormones. And in total, we looked at about 100 different individual chemicals, ranging from antibiotics to fire retardants to DEET, detergent metabolites, personal care products, so compounds that we find in our shampoos and our toothpaste and that sort of thing. And then also hormones, both natural and man-made hormone chemicals. So as far as detections go, we had detections in a number of different locations, most of them being in the Twin Cities metro area and in the St. Cloud area. With the highest number detected in any particular well was 10 individual chemicals. And we'll take a little bit a closer look at the wells, the particular wells that these were found in on the next slide. First, we'll look at what was most detected. And now this is small. This tris-dichlorophenyl phosphate, which is a firefighting foam component. And then again, we see the sulfamethoxazole and diethylstilbestrol, which are also their pharmaceutical chemicals, and then bisphenol A, which is a plasticizer, was also one of the more commonly detected, but still relatively small number of wells had any detections at all of these chemicals. Most concentrations were pretty low. More than 80% of these detections were less than 1 microgram per liter. And the way the USGS reports out results, if the laboratory is confident that they have detected the chemical, even if they can't quantify the exact amount, they'll report that as a detection with a detection level. And so 50% of the reported detections were actually below that reporting limit. And no concentrations exceeded a health guidance value. But on the other hand, most of the chemicals don't have any health guidance value. So, you know, it's one of those things that's important to say, knowing that that's part of what health is working on right now, is to look at some of these things that don't have any health-based guidance. We did find that the landfill leachate did have an effect on groundwater, even though the traditional monitoring for the landfill didn't really indicate that these wells were still under the influence of the leachate. These did have the greatest number of detections and the highest sum total of detections. So the landfill wells had up to 10 chemicals with total concentrations up to about 14 micrograms per liter, where the non-landfill wells only had up to 4 chemicals detected with a total concentration of only about 3 micrograms per liter. So a little bit different subset there. What we'll be doing over the next few years of sampling is trying to move away from some of these locations that we really suspect have some strong influences, and look at more settings that are less well understood. So a general suburban development that has a septic system, have septic systems, individual septic systems, for example, or a regular urban neighborhood where there is a centralized wastewater treatment plant, but you know, people want to keep their lawns green and that sort of thing. And so looking at lots of different types of land use settings to try and get a more general look at the urban landscape, or pardon me, the non-agricultural landscape. Not necessarily urban, non-agricultural. So by land use setting, outside of the landfill wells, in the Seward residential, Only about 25% of the wells had detections. With septic systems, over 40% had detections, and then undeveloped, again, was similar to the Seward residential setting. But again, this is only 40 wells. We're just, you know, we're only 40 wells into at least 200, so we're just getting started here. The detections of the endocrine active chemicals were bisphenol A, transdiethyl distilbestrol, and 4-cumulphenol. So those are the four particular EACs that were detected as part of this particular phase of the study. So far, especially so far, we're not describing in general the conditions throughout the aquifers, and we really have a lot of, the data is very limited at this point, and so stay tuned. We'll have more to report as the sampling continues over the next few years. So again, detections in EACs in 3 wells. Most of the wells near landfills had the largest number of detections, and we'll be doing further monitoring as the years go on to do the refining. 2 reports document the results of the groundwater studies that I just talked about. One is a Pollution Control Agency publication, and the other is a USGS publication, and the links to them are there. If you go to the posting of the talk later, you can get these links and go there, or even just search PCA website and USGS website, you'll find them. And finally, I again want to say, this is the work of a huge number of people. This is not just me by any respect. It's me and many of my colleagues in USGS and across academia and across our state and local partners conducting this work. And so I just want to call out a few that I could recall by name and found on publications as I was preparing for the talk. And not even mentioning by name the army of samplers that has been at work over the years collecting all these samples. So funding was provided by the USGS Cooperative Water Program and the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment through PCA, which was described really nicely by Lanya. So I was appreciated her input on that, or her introduction to that. And now I'll take any questions if you have them.
One of your slides was exposure studies where there was little containers of whatever, tadpoles or fish or something that were being exposed to some of these various chemicals. And maybe I just missed it, but were there any particular chemicals implicated specifically in these, you know, feminizing fish or other?
If you send me a note, I can put you in touch with the people who can answer specific questions, because not only is that not my research, it was way before my time. So, but I can help you find answers to that if you're interested. Yep. Calvin?
Have you done any testing of municipal water supplies for these chemicals?
There's actually a report already published on some work that was done on municipal water supplies, and I can get you the reference to that report. That it was a decent study. It found something similar to what we're finding now, is that there's low-level detections in some source waters for drinking water, public water.
Are the reports on these studies already on some website?
Yes, they're on the USGS website. We have a publications warehouse. So I would hope if you Google USGS publications warehouse, you'll land at that site. And if you search by chemicals, specific chemicals you're interested, or if you search by public water system, groundwater, EACs, you know, contaminants of emerging concern, that sort of thing, you should be able to come up with some of these publications. Or send me an email, and I will send you the direct link to the reports. That's fine, too. Ginny.
Mindy, the landfills that you were looking at, were they all unlined, or were some of those lined landfills?
Sherry, can you answer that? Is it unlined?
Yes, they're all unlined.
Unlined landfills. So they're part of the closed landfill program? Is that correct, Sherry? Yeah. Oh.
Gilbert.
Gil.
Mindy, are you getting salt part per trillion detections that you can report?
We are, and when I'll be doing a report this fall that will have a very detailed summary of the results that we have.
Where do you get the standards for some of these chemicals?
I'd have to refer you to our lab people. That is not my deal.
So what's the lowest level you can?
5 parts per trillion for some of the analyses. Most of them are more in the part per billion range, but 5 parts per trillion for one particular.
But schedule. They have criteria for being able to report below that.
whatever the individual reporting level is for an individual compound on a particular analytical method, you know. So it varies between analyte too. I mean, some of them are easier and have better response. Some of them are poorer. So some of them have high detection levels. Some of them are very low. So it's very all over the board in terms of reporting levels. Me personally? A non-detect?
Part per quadrillion?
Oh, that's what you mean. Okay. Yeah, quadrillion it would be. Well, I think it would be a quadrillion. Should we take a vote?
Call it a part per million.
No, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, just a quick question. Caffeine was in there. Is that considered a chemical of concern?
It's unregulated, so that's part of the interest. Part of what we're interested in is things that we know we are discharging a lot of into our waters, and we don't have any regulatory limits, and we don't really know if it matters if our fish are buzzed or not. I mean, does it matter? Who knows?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, thanks so much, and well, be sure to come in the fall. There will be an update.
That's right.